Hi. For the record, my name is Kent Fitch. Thanks for inviting me here today. I was just totally blown away by that last presentation. I was reflecting during it that Monica must be the sort of pleasant, reasoned face of good common sense, I thought. So for the next half an hour, maybe you'll see the face of barely suppressed frustration. But the good news, if you're some sort of sicko masochist, you're going to enjoy the next half hour much more than the last one. I hope. To start with, I'll try to share some assumptions that I'm going to make in the rest of this presentation. And the first one is that I'm assuming that you're really passionate about libraries and facilitating public access to information and culture. And secondly, that you're probably extremely worried about how libraries are going to survive as access to information and culture is becoming increasingly commercialised. I'd like to emphasise I don't want this increasingly commercialised word sounds like I'm being judgmental about it, but in fact, probably the opposite. I think the reason people are turning to services like Google over libraries, as Monica just mentioned, is because they do a much better job. And the only reason I've used libraries in the past, it's been like the reason we used the PMG and Telco, Telstra, in 1990. There was no alternative. But there are alternatives now, and it's our job in this field to make sure that we sort of step up to the plate, to use a cliche. But where I'm coming from, I'd like to describe some things that I think normal people worry about and that are questions that we have to, in our professional lives, see if we're doing the right work to answer them. Very simple questions such as, people in the streets who want to have questions like this, such as, I've got a 10-year-old who's interested in Egyptian art. What can I do to find them resources that are going to keep them exploring that? Or right down to detailed questions such as this, that I have an ongoing interest in, ongoing disease resistance of genetically modified canola. What's the best way to keep track of what's happening in that field? I want to study critical analysis of tactics used by Whitlam in 1975 during the constitutional crisis. Where should I start? And something that's quite difficult is I'm interested in social impacts of railways in Midwest America during the 19th century. What aspects of this are worth exploring, and where should I start, and what should I do next? Now, these are often questions that someone would lob up into a library and ask a reference librarian, which was fantastic. But the problem is reference librarians don't really scale that well. They don't scale to the internet. So what do we do? Well, why bother cataloguing at all, I guess, is a fair question. Traditionally, there have been various approaches to answering that question. Charles Cutter was basically what he laid out was, you know, so you can find stuff, show what's available, and assist in the choice. And the card catalogue pretty much addressed these needs very well. An FRBR report of 1998 sort of was predicated or took as a starting point some tasks that the authors assumed users wanted to do, which they called quite explicitly find, identify, select, and obtain. And a more recent description by this German librarian, Eversberg, who's quite prominent on, probably some of you know him from NGC4Lib and Code4Lib, is pretty much a reformulating of those, not very radically different, to produce reliable results for a known item search and see what's there, clearly display differences and additions that help you make a choice, and group things together, often so you can find related resources. And works by same author or about the same work. But if that's all we're going to do, I'm wondering if it's really worth continuing. Is it necessary? Has cataloguing left the building, as we've just been asked? If you go to Google nowadays and you want to search for, say, a video of something that was made quite a long time ago, 30 years ago in this case, by a American group called Little Feet, Dixie Chicken. You just type in Little Feet and you only get to type in the DIX of Dixie and the results are presented for you as if it's sort of vaguely reading your mind. I didn't even get to type in the word video, but the one I want is the first result there. And if that's not what I want, there's a stack of material underneath it from, in this case, ironically, Amazon, which will sell me the CD, get the lyrics and those sorts of things. So is there a library catalogue around at the moment where you can do anything like that and get as good a result? And I think we know the answer. If you want to find out the melting point of sulphur, now the problem is if you try this at a library, you'll probably get an answer. But on Google, you'll notice you get two answers, which is twice as good, both 115.21 and 112.8. So if that doesn't make you want to research further into the melting point of sulphur, I don't know what would. And another interesting thing is that I didn't actually get to spell the word sulphur as I learned how to spell it. Google have decided that it's S-U-L-F-U-R, which I guess it could be, and it's completed the search for me like that. Macbeth study. You don't even have to type in the word study guide, and all of a sudden you've got Spark Notes as the first result and Cliff Notes down there somewhere else. So again, going back to Ranganathan, I think one of his commandments was save the time of the user. You notice that you don't even have to read the study guide because the various results there, the second one, in fact, offers you an essay. So that's a huge time saver. You don't even have to know how to spell. My daughter is interested in Buddhism at the moment, and she's actually an excellent speller, but I'm not. So when I try and search for resources, possibly for her, I can type in Buddhism as I'd spell it and get corrected by Google and given exactly what I want to find just a mouse click away. In fact, this sort of weird ability of Google to auto-complete is... there's a new genre of web humour. LCSH would probably call this, I don't know, humour dash dash internet dash dash search engines dash dash auto completion. The person who did this pointed out that if you have to ask, it's probably wrong. But there's a whole stack of them. It is a. I like the last one the best. The funny thing is, if you actually get to complete that one, or if you start typing in drunks, then an amazing thing happens, but I'll let you try that for yourself. But it's just evidence of the incredible natural language processing Google's doing. Something more difficult, that Railway Society Midwest 19th century type query is much harder. In fact, Google doesn't do a great job of that at all. There's some reasonable results. The Spark Notes on the Gilded Age are probably a good place to start. But then when you try that in Trove, the results are even worse. I think we come up with the Woodlanders, Thomas Hardy as the... And I got no idea except unless someone's confused Thomas Hardy with Thomas the Tank Engine Hardy, which... That's an author created by Fred Dagg. So possibly something's gone on there. On OCLC's WorldCat, it's much the same. The first result is bizarrely, you can't read it there, but it's a manuscript covering the periods 1938 to 2000. That's also on Trove, by the way, because it comes from Oyster. But it's pretty much irrelevant to this query. So how does Google do it? Well, they're magic, we know that. They basically have a popularity contest on pages and incredibly sophisticated natural language processing that people always downplay. The Irish are drunk example, if you actually type that in and see it, the suggestions it comes up with, it actually suggests really what you want to find out about alcoholism in the in certain communities. And that is just amazing that it does that. Again, what library systems do we think are capable of doing that? And why would people use library systems when they're not getting that sort of functionality? Of course, they have tens of thousands of servers and lots of clever people, and the whole thing is driven by AdWords. Their financial statements for 2010, you can see the revenue there, top right-hand corner. That's million, so that's $22.8 billion. And the increase on the previous year was about $1.6 billion. That was during the global financial crisis, a very disappointing year, where they only increased their revenue by more than the total amount that's spent in libraries in Australia, public and universities. Happily, though, they've reported that for the first or the third quarter of this year, financial year, their revenues are up 25%. So all systems go at Google again. Now, I just want to, while I'm being depressive, talk about metadata. I don't know how many people have read this essay by Cory Doctorow from 2001, but whenever I ask anyone if they have, they always say no, and it makes me sad. So I'm going to highlight extremely quickly why metadata doesn't work. Firstly, people lie. Your mailbox is full of spam with information you requested. People are lazy. You get mail with no subject line. Your boss, of course, saves things as untitled.doc. And it's bottomless. There's nothing you can possibly do about it. Now, saying people are stupid, I think, is rather harsh, although I have seen more MARC records created by you good folk than you'd care to believe. And my team, or the team I work with, who are probably up the back somewhere, Simon and Joe, who have suffered through the sort of plam pilot on eBay mistakes that you wouldn't believe. I think we had a language called NG, which was probably the most popular language in the world after English, because of an encoding error. But never mind. Once the data's in MARC, by the way, it's incredibly, in catalogues, extremely hard to get out again. Now, mission impossible. Know yourself, and I think this has been alluded to already this morning, but David mentioned the anthropology aspects of his study. It's very important to watch what people do, not ask them what they do, because no one's got a clue. If you ask a programmer how long it's going to take to write a program, they've got no idea. If you ask a someone who's meant to fix your roof how long it's going to take them to do it, they've got no idea. And if you ask people what they want on television, they seem to get confused. They seem to think they're watching things like Masterpiece Theatre and Sesame Street, but the advertisers all know exactly what they're watching. But getting us slightly more serious now, the Doctorow's discussion, schema aren't neutral, and this is a huge problem, that even with the best will in the world, people who are describing something as simple as washing machines, here's his example, someone will have how energy efficient it is as a top-level hierarchy, then within that it will be maybe its size and what colours it comes in. Someone else, equally valid, will have as their top-level criteria how much energy it uses, or whether it's top-loading or front-loading, and then perhaps size, and then how programmable it is. And there's no real way of getting them to agree on that. And one of the reasons there's no real right way is that people want to emphasise different things. For example, as Doctorow says, software that's easy to use probably isn't secure. Desserts that are sort of decadent aren't very healthy. So how you measure your dessert, whether it's decadence or health, depends on how you're looking at things. And finally, and most importantly, there's more than one way of describing things, and that reasonable people will disagree forever on how to describe something, and that arguably all we are is a set of descriptions that we've made for everything, so requiring everyone to use the same vocabulary would be not a good thing, or, as he puts it very dramatically, it's just not right. So if it's just not right, here's an example of what happens. If you're on the Open Library discussion list, which I can recommend, then you might have seen this exchange last week about how to catalogue series. And Tim Spalding from Library Thing says, we've been doing this for a while on our user-generated content or user engagement type area, and it is really, really hard. The things that, whether something belongs to a series or not is not clear-cut. And disregarding the fact that probably the cataloguers would prefer to have publisher series and author series, even within that, there's degrees of truth, differences of opinion, different levels of hierarchy. And importantly, who's saying something is extremely important. And examples are Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn in the same series. When did they become so? What about those James Bond books? And what about sequels, sequels to Jane Eyre that are published by someone else, a long time after. The Order of the Narnia books, I'm sorry, I'm ignorant about that. But the next one's a good one. Does the Harvard Classics include the Odyssey? Well, obviously. But is the Odyssey part of the series Harvard Classics? And probably it isn't unless you're the publisher of the Harvard Classics. So what is a series, even something like that? Well, what makes it all start to have a chance of being successful at all is by adding an awful lot of context to things, adding more information. So some of the things I'd like to talk about in the next 10 minutes are these things. So FRBR, series, lists, subject trails, citations, related works, reviews, annotations and ratings, and importantly, the provenance and the scope of that data. That it's vital that that's recorded and presented to users and they can engage in it. If you have a look at a typical, very popular book, a classic, Patent Language by Christopher Alexander, the subjects in the NBD are rather sparse. If you look at the same tags in Wikipedia articles that describe this book, they're a bit longer. If you look at them in Library Thing, there's even more. And on Amazon, quite a few more. And some of them you might think are weird, like paradigm shifting, for goodness sakes. But if someone's interested in paradigm shifting architecture books, that actually could be handy. So it's hard to dismiss even the weird stuff. And of course, in Amazon, there's these reviews. Now, I know what you're thinking. This is all popularist crap that we don't need in clogging up our library systems. Who wants to read a review? We're only dealing with academics, right? But the problem is that... well, I don't know. Sorry, I shouldn't speak for you. But the problem is, if you're an academic, then you're probably really interested in this information, that what cites this book and what does this book cite? And do you get that from your library catalogue? Well, not yet, no. So, again, why are you going to use it? Why wouldn't you just do everything on Amazon or Google? Because even better, I think Amazon had about 100 citations for that book. Google Scholar, which knows about articles, has 2,323. So this is really interesting information for people who want to follow citation chains. Right, that's gone off somewhere to the top. But this is another classic. Just comparing the how it's classified in different systems, you can see in the NBD where we've got lots of holdings from 31 libraries. It's a book from 1979, so it's probably been thrown away by a few of them. But it's still a classic. And look, just compare the amount of data. And in fact, it gets truncated. If you look at it in detail on Wikipedia, this book is extremely widely written about. And the things you can't see are more reviews. On Library Thing, there's related books. And in Google Scholar, there's just 20-something thousand citations for this thing. Okay, so two problems. According to Doctorow, schemas aren't neutral and there's more than one way of describing things. According to Weinberg, who I'll come to in a second, control of this doesn't scale whatsoever. So what did libraries do? Well, I think there's a choice. There's this business-as-usual scenario where we're just imagining that cataloguing hasn't left the building and we stay in the building and do some of the ARCR2, RDA, LCSH stuff. But basically, we're going to remain a small ecosystem and probably no one will annoy us very much. Because we're ignoring them, so it's only fair. The other option is to adapt and grow, and new approaches, become open to the web, build scalable descriptive frameworks, and that's what I want to really talk about in the remaining 5 minutes. describe everything, add context to everything, and help everyone participate so everyone's happy. But before I get into that, more pain. LCSH, I just hate it. I can't believe you guys stick with it. Really, you've got to get over it. Throw it away. It's not a thesaurus. Broadening, narrowing doesn't work, and it's very hard for everyone to use. And this isn't news. A few years ago, Kelly McGrath, who is a dyed-in-the-wool cataloguer with impeccable credentials that I've spelled out in huge detail there, says in an article in Code for Live, it's basically rubbish. There's 2,000 items at the top level just describing music, for God's sake. So, try browsing that. It doesn't work. Compound headings break things. Her example that I like best is communicable diseases in Kenya, because things are classified... That would be AIDS Kenya is a library subject, LCSH term, a heading, I should say. If you want to find communicable diseases or sexually transmitted diseases in sub-Saharan Africa, you're on your own. LCSH just makes it harder. What's the point of it? Now, the sad thing is, Kelly McGrath is not the first. In fact, this article, which comes from Library Journal 1988, found without any help of the library, thanks very much, is a terrible, a stinging criticism of LCSH. So this stuff's been around for a very long time. I'd like to read these bits out, but I don't have time. So just remember the heading and try and find it in your own library catalogue. But basically she's saying, if we don't do something, people are going to ignore us. LCSH is a complete joke. Automated systems are going to make us irrelevant. Do something now. Next. Okay, so the reason commerce is taking over bibliographic description and control, and both big and large players, these huge people here, and small people who are distressingly actually owned by the larger players increasingly, is because libraries haven't provided them the service they've needed. And Eric Lees-Malding, a librarian who came here last 2 years ago, said that find and acquire are library goals, they're not the goals of the user, and that the fundamental process of librarianship needs to be expanded to fit the current digital environment. The next generation catalogue is not about find, instead it's about how those materials are used and analysed. And you wrote a wonderful essay on that. Again, I recommend that to you. So, what to do? We have 5 minutes to go? Possibly. Okay. These are some things I think we should do together. Thrive on a diversity of description. Remember that only a tiny percentage of information will ever be described in our precious and our beloved standards, and that percentage is going to continue to decline. We have to encourage and combine the expertise of the whole community, which is librarians an incredibly important part of it, but so are subject experts and members of the general public. They have to be utilised. We have to facilitate these things. Description using a real thesaurus. The web is crying out for a real thesaurus. Description using tags is completely uncontrolled. Letting anyone create lists of things, related resources, reviews, annotations, collections and organisations of snippets that people will want to. And for example, the Kindle does this, the Amazon tool. You can make a snippet, anyone can see it, you can see your own snippets. Incredibly handy. We have to link out to other resources and expect them and help them link into us. We have to automatically perform certain things that we can just do with technology that Google do and Amazon do. Reading level characterisation, identification of characteristic text, citation chaining, related resources, people who access this also access that. Textual analysis, like what type of writing is it, and automatically link out to related resources. We have to support metadata services to support versioning, subsets, views and layers so that everyone doesn't have to see the same thing. That if you only want to see comments by your friends or people you trust or people who are highly rated in the community to get rid of the noise, that's fantastic. Everything should be capable of attribution, so you know who's put it there, if they want to identify themselves. And the metadata that users add themselves can be rated. Systems have to be open, very easy to reuse, arbitrarily extended, and commercially disinterested. On the easy-to-use thing, I think it's worthwhile having a look at... of course, David's talk this morning has reminded me how important XC is, and I apologise for omitting that here, but I suggest you have a close look at XC and also Open Library. Open Library are doing incredibly good things about one web page for a book, and it's encouraging lay people, normal people like me, to describe books. I also encourage you to join the Open Knowledge Foundation Working Group on Open Bibliographic Data, who are coming up with schemas. I hope they're working with XC, I'm not sure. And perhaps more loftier, think about creating an international public digital library, which some of you may have read an article written by Robert Darnton, the director of Harvard University Library, who's realised this predicament libraries are in, that they have to get into this area of giving people online access to materials and describing those materials extremely well and helping the public engage with those users and contribute their own descriptions and expand them along the lines of what Monica has just talked about. So finally, I'd like to leave you with these thoughts from David Weinberger, who gave a talk to a library group in America, a large library group, on the theme of knowledge as a network, that knowledge is no longer bound up in books, but it's really the connections and the context between books, people, other resources that's important, and which is actually the natural sphere of libraries to operate in. He says, without librarians and what librarians understand, what we build is likely to be less usable, less reliable, less diverse, and less provocative. And I especially like the less provocative. What we build without librarians would unnecessarily constrict our understanding and imagination rather than exuberantly expanding them. And this is especially true given that the systems are being designed to a large degree by commercial entities. And completely finally, don't worry about control. Don't worry about power, because a librarian's real role in society is about unleashing things. So I'd like you to bear in mind Harriet Rubin's words. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Ken. Very inspiring talk. The floor is open for a couple of questions.
Kent, you describe LCSH as not being a real thesaurus, and I think there are many in the room who might actually agree with that. Could you define what a real thesaurus actually is?
Sure. Well, this isn't my area of expertise, but I do have that paper, which I'll give you a photocopy of, if you want, the one from 1988. But the important thing is that a thesaurus consists of terms rather than subject headings. And there's many classic problems with subject headings in Library of Congress that make it impossible to reliably do things such as broader, narrower terms, although things that, like, I know children is defined as a broader term than children and television, or television and children in LCSH, which is just completely stupid. It doesn't work. It breaks faceting. And why it breaks is that if someone wants to do a narrower term or a broader term on children and television, they want to broaden their search on children and television, they're not actually going to find information on children useful. They're going to find it as noise. Similarly, if you have a subject heading such as AIDS Kenya, then, or in fact, cookery Japanese, then the AIDS Kenya one, if you do actually want to find sexually transmitted diseases in sub-Saharan Africa, those headings don't help you at all. You have to try every combination of sexually transmitted disease and every combination of sub-Saharan Africa countries or localities that you guess this thing has been catalogued under. So moving to something that's strictly, and there are lots of thesaurus that use terms rigorously and hence allow that broader and narrower of search, and faceting as well, much, much better.
Thanks very much. That brings the morning sessions to a close.